To the Henchman's Lounge Podcast. Everybody, welcome to the Henchman's Lounge. Once again, this is Captain Frugal.
This is Henchman number one reporting in.
And this is podcast number two from our hidden lair. Hopefully you enjoyed the first podcast. Once again, we're working on some technical issues, making it better each time. And hopefully you find this time even better than the last.
Woo-hoo! Sakes alive, whatever you do, don't go in there.
All right, so the first thing I'd like to start off with is a review. I received an issue in the mail because I do subscriptions, and this is not a normal issue I'd run out and buy, but one of my issues ran the subscription, they discontinued, so they automatically gave me this one, which is the Squadron Sinister number one. Now, looking over it, it's written by Mark Guggenheim, I believe is how you say it. Penciler Carlos Pacheco, is that Mark?
Pacheco?
Pacheco, okay, whatever. And do I really need to go over, like, the inker?
No,
All right, they can go through that on themselves and look it up. This is published by Marvel Comics. It's the part of the Secret Wars tie-ins. So, which I haven't read a whole lot of because, well, to be honest, it's almost more like a jumping off point to me than a jumping on, I think, at this point. But I'm trying to suffer through it. I'm going to see him try to educate myself on it. Now, with this situation, this is a story about this team. It's sort of like the Squadron Supreme, but it's the evil side of them.
Right.
Right. And so there lies part of the problem with it, too. It introducts them into Battle World. Okay, so we got this team here, and this is all about the villains, and this team is stomping all over their neighborhood districts and their personal bid for evil power, if you will. Guggenheim opens up on this issue of the Squadron Sinister killing their counterparts, and from the Supreme Powers series. That was from Michael Straczynski, J. Michael Straczynski, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, right.
For those of you unfamiliar, Squadron Sinister are Marvel's long-standing copycat versions of DC's Justice League. Hyperion is Superman, Nighthawk would be Batman, Wizard would represent the Flash, and on and on and so forth. They had a wide variety of different roles and interpretations over the years, and then this time around, they're more like a cabal, a gang of supervillains who do evil things for evil reasons. They do what they call annexing the neighboring districts in the name of protecting their own district, and the rule of their they rule over all their subjects with an iron fist, clearly, if you can see that in the first few pages of the
Terror. People are getting disintegrated and smacked around and arms ripped off and all kinds of crazy things in the first couple of pages.
Yeah. And this story involves the squadron also distrusting each other as they go on a stealth mission to the neighboring district to steal a weapon with the power to defeat Hyperion. Now, they do this in order to keep it out of the enemy's hands, but simultaneously, one of the Thors arrive to check on their activities, and he winds up dead. The mystery in this book is we don't know who killed him. And the squadron has to figure out who killed them and why before God Doom of the realm finds out and kills them all in retaliation. That whole thing during the Secret Wars, evidently Doom is the ruler pretty much of everything, and they've broken down to segments and who controls what segment. Now, the problem I find with this issue, this is once again Squadron Sinister number one, is it lacks an interesting focal point.
Right.
First of all, what's the main goal of the book?
Right. I guess we were talking earlier, and I think the thing to start is Stan Lee said, imagine and pretend that every comic is somebody's first comic. So when you handed me this copy, I was looking at it, and my first thought it was a DC book because I saw the little, Adam signs at the top, and the way the heroes are on the side of the cover, it looked like an old 1970s Justice League cover, and I thought, oh, it's a DC book. But way in the bottom of the book, in small print, is you see Marvel with their Secret Wars. You go, oh, okay, I guess it's a Marvel book. And then it, you know, keyed me in that the characters, you know, were basically spoofs or, you know, or Marvel's equivalent of DC characters like Superman and Batman and so on. And it was just like, okay, great. So what do I make of this? I don't know.
Yeah, for, you know, Hyperion's Superman, of course. Nighthawk is Batman. Dr. Spectrum, maybe Green Lantern?
Maybe, or it could be Captain Atom.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Wizard, be Flash. Warrior Woman.
Wonder Woman.
Who.
Angry man-hating Amazonian, apparently, as opposed to Wonder Woman.
Yeah. And I will say, the story had interesting plots and subplots, and as well as action scenes. But as I said, it had that lack of direction. And on top of that, with all the current confusion that we've been provided with this whole secret battle world crap and everything else,
yep.
There's no real explanation building up their world here and why they're there.
Yeah, it, you know, again, that whole first, you know, everybody's book is somebody's first book concept. You know, if we've got the Secret Wars going on, and let's say that I didn't read Secret Wars number one, you know, by Marvel or any of the other books, there's no battle map. So if all these people are taking over this map and there's this huge big battle going on everywhere, I have no idea where these characters are in space and time, what's actually going on. You know, Dr. Doom apparently is now God of the universe somehow. And I got the first Secret Wars and he's talking to God or he's talking to Jack Kirby or whoever the God of the Marvel Universe is. But I think it's Jack Kirby, isn't it? Isn't he the one above all?
At this point, who knows?
Who knows now, but... You know, to sit and pick this book up out of nowhere, it just doesn't really leave you with a lot to start with. I mean, it does end on kind of a note because these characters are going to, you know, plot against each other. And, you know, they're plotting underhanded things because they're villains. But it's like, why would I want to root for a villain? You know, I mean, I hope they all kind of get backstabbed or maybe one of them will turn good or something. Who knows?
You bring up a good point. We're pushed into politics of these characters right away and how they butt heads with each other, which is somewhat interesting on Battle World as a whole, but no one really stands out as particularly memorable or fun to read in this book. But then again, to be fair, I've never been a big fan of the Squadron Supreme either, so maybe that has some appeal to it. The comics is all about scheming in this book. And distrust between its members. We don't really know anything about them, though, as people. And we're definitely not really enough to care, to feel invested. They don't really get into any of that. Guggenheim plugs in personality traits here and there, sure, like how the wizard is a wise ass, and maybe Dr. Spectrum is a bit of a wuss, a pansy, a scaredy cat, whatever. Yeah. That's not enough really to make it interesting to me.
I don't know. It's again, if you think, you know, there's a book called Save the Cat, and it talks about how do you make a character likable from the beginning. And basically you have somebody and he's in the beginning of a movie and something happens. There's a little kitten or a cat. And somebody will pick up the cat and rescue the cat or do something with the cat. Even in the first Superman movie with Christopher Reeve, you see Superman saves a cat early on in the beginning of that film, which may be where the term came from. It's a great book. Pick that up called Save the Cat. I think it's Scott. It's not Scott Snyder. It's something Snyder is the author. But anyway, this book is kind of the opposite. So I would say the opposite of Save the Cat is Kick the Puppy. And
Kick the Puppy.
These villains right off the bat are, you know, mean to people, they're ruthless to people, and you're kind of wondering, like, where's the hope? What am I supposed to be rooting for here? Like, do I want these guys to actually conquer neighboring provinces or whatever? And it's just like, No, not really. I mean, is everything in this world supposed to be gloomy and doomy because Dr. Doom rules it? Again, I don't know because it's my first book. So what's the appeal for reading the book? I mean, aside from the mystery, there's a little mystery at the end of the book and there's a little backstabbing plotting and that could make it interesting and maybe they're going with a Game of Thrones vibe, but you got to have somebody to root for. You're just not going to keep reading the book.
Well, yeah, I can see the Game of Thrones vibe. There's sex in it right off the bat, too, with Hyperion and Warrior Woman.
Yeah, they're...
Or at least a hint at it.
And it also makes you wonder about the target age for this book. You know, if you want more teenagers reading the book, do they want to see, you know, Hyperion and you know, Wonder Woman. The woman, supposedly not Wonder Woman, Warrior Woman, shacking up. I don't know. I mean, maybe not. But it's, you know, superhero fights and super, you know, it's almost like wrestling matches. And I was just thinking about, I don't know if we talked about the last podcast that I talked about this.
I don't think so.
The wrestling match concept is that when a superhero when they fight. Like, you know, at the beginning of a book, you'll see, you know, Spider-Man, and he'll be fighting, like, the enforcers. You know, he'll slap some people around, these lower-level minions of the Kingpin or something like that, and then the real story starts. Then we know, oh, okay, he's going to be fighting, you know, the Green Goblin, or he'll be fighting Dr. Octopus. That's the real match we want to see. You know, that's the no-holds-barred cage match versus, you know, oh, a couple bank robbers. Well, that's really going to that save the cat mindset. That's really the, with superheroes, it's kind of like in the beginning, we see Spider-Man or Superman or Batman taking out a few goons who are doing something wrong. And then we go, oh, this is the good guy. And so there isn't really that hook in the beginning of this comic.
Though they did lead up to they're going to fight the Frightful Four.
They will fight the Frightful Four, another group of supervillains.
Yeah.
Who fight the Fantastic Four, which makes me wonder, well, where's the Fantastic Four? And then I saw the Thor, Iron Man, Iron Thor, I think that's what they called him. And I just thought, so if Iron Man and Thor had a baby, this would be their baby. And, like, well, why isn't Iron Man there? Why isn't Thor there? Again, I don't know because, you know, the writers didn't key you into that. So I guess maybe they assume you're going to go pick up Secret Wars number one or assume you go to the website. But is that a good thing to assume? Or maybe they should just say, well, we'll just say in case you don't have internet access, what are you going
to
do?
Right. I guess because in order to understand that the Thors are like the police force of Dr. Doom or the maps of the Battle World, you got to go online to get the maps for Battle World, you know, or actually read in the Secret Wars to understand really what's going on here. How about the art? What'd you think about that?
Overall, I like the art. It's Carlos Pacheco does the art. It reminded me of another book series that I was reading by Image Comics called Black Science. And there's a guy named Mateo Stellera, I think that's how you pronounce his name. His artwork is very similar to the Carlos Pacheco. It's very, this kind of illustrated, almost like 1950s cover art type style. I mean, I liked it. Overall, I think it's good. I don't think there's anything out of the ordinary or bad. You know, there's like in Nighthawk's lair, I don't know if it's his Nighthawk cave or whatever, but there's like the dollar bill encased instead of like Batman, how he's the giant penny. So I thought there's kind of a wink and a nod. Like these are like the dark alternate versions of the Justice League. And I think that's fine and all, but, you know, those are DC characters. I can get making, you know, spoofing them and whatnot, but it's sort of like, you know, how much care do you actually have about these characters?
Yeah, that's the part I had too. I mean, the art I thought was good, but it wasn't so fantastic. It made me go, man, I've got to read these about these characters anyway. But as I said, I've never been that involved in them. So it didn't make me go, well, let's pick up this book. Because to be honest, if I went to a comic shop based on the cover art and what I seen there and the characters, I would never pick this book up. The only reason I read it is because it came to my house.
Yep. Yeah. We're spoiled because we grew up in, I think, in what was like one of the best times to collect comics. That was in the 70s and 80s. And when you saw covers back then, you know, they pulled you in. You saw the covers, and you'd be like, I got to have this book. Like, if you look through, Marvel was, you know, both Marvel and DC were really throwing everything at the wall and trying to sell books back then. So they were much more innovative and creative. You could look like an old series like Chamber of Chills. You know, or Weird War Tales, where basically there's something going on, you know, on the cover, and it's just so weird, mysterious, or whatnot, that you got to pick the book up. You know, or if you picked up The Amazing Spider-Man back in the 70s or 80s, you know, there's one of the earlier ones, or one of the comics I got in the 80s was Spider-Man is fighting Fire Lord. I think it's like, well, I can't remember what number that was, but holy cow, it's awesome. She's Spider-Man, he's like dodging this fire blast from Fire Lord. And, you know, it was that kind of conflict, because that sets it up. Again, it goes with that idea of comics, is you're looking for the main event. Who is my superhero going to be fighting this month? And on the cover of this book, they're all standing around like dark warriors, and somebody's got his, you know, Hyperion has his foot on top of some henchman or minion or something.
I think it's
like
Dr. Spectrum, actually.
Okay, could be Dr. Spectrum. Could be Dr. Zero or whoever. I don't know. People just die left and right in this book. So there's that.
You know, and one issue I have, too, is being that this is through the Secret Wars and the current way that Marvel's going, I'm a little negligent to want to pick up a new series. My question right off the bat is, without having a clear cut, what's the main goal? How long is this series even going
to
last?
Yeah, this is probably 1 to 4 book stops, and then they're done. Because, what is it, JR from the Spider-Man Crawl Space was saying that, hey, the fans don't matter anymore, but all these, you know, spin-offs seem to be like a what-if series. Like, what if Sinister Squadron did something? What if Spider-Man did something else? Or what if, like, well, those are great stories, but they're not going to sustain you over the long haul because you're like, well, what happens next?
Now, if this book all of a sudden picks up 50,000 readers, yeah, I could see it continuing on, but Marvel, that's getting to be a stretch nowadays.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I guess overall, when I look at this book, I see is a bunch of characters we don't really know, or they don't trust one another in any context that we really know about. The characters aren't from any beloved Marvel history, so there's no real reason to connect with them, and there just seems to be no promise in anything more interesting around the corner for this book. If I was to give it a grade, I wouldn't say it's a bad book, actually.
Right.
The subplots actually sell the book. I like the subplots. That would make me want to pick up a book more than anything else. But it just, as I said, the characters I'm not really invested in, which could be me. And the only thing really, there was no main plot to carry me. The only thing that carries me is the subplots, like between Nighthawk and Hyperion and Warrior Woman.
Yep.
So I'd give it a C, an average book.
Yeah, for the story, I'd give it a C, C+. For the artwork, I gave it a B+. The book costs $3.99, and I'd buy it for a dollar.
Yeah, I wouldn't go to the store and see it on the shelf for $3.99 and want to pick it up. And that brings up another point. With these high price points, how likely are you to go to the comic shop like you used to be and go, I'm going to try this book? Because I remember when I used to go, you know, many years, I mean, they were under a dollar. It's like, oh, I could pick up this. If I could pick up this, you could bring a few bucks and try out some stuff. But at $3.99 a pop, you have to sell me before I pick up that book, which is quite a challenge.
Yeah, you know, what's minimum wage now, about $8 an hour? So if these are $3.99 a pop, you get two comic books for an hour's worth of work. And, you know, for when we were kids, you could pick up about four comics for about an hour's worth of work, maybe five. And that was before they had things like bargain bins and things like that. So today it's almost like everything is bargain bin bait. And, you know, like there's all these Convergence books and all these what if spinoffs for Secret Wars Battle World. And I'm sure I'll have fun just drop $10, you know, $20 at the bargain bin and pick up 10, 20 comics. So we'll see. But would I spend $4 on this? No.
All right, to jump gears to the next subject, how about the Flash television show? Are you current on that?
I watched the Flash television show. I liked it. I liked how they mixed it in with the Arrow show, the Green Arrow. It started to light the Green Arrow show up a little bit. I think they have, what is it, the Atom, I think, is on the...
Atom's Green. In it. Firestar's in it.
Oh, yeah.
Firestar, I'm sorry. It's,
Firestorm is in Firestorm. The Flash, but... the Atom is in the Green Arrow show. So you can start to see they're all starting to create like a mini Justice League.
Oh, that's right. I kind of mixed up.
Yeah, I know. They start intertwining because they're on each other's shows.
Actually, what they're going to do is a show called League of Legends.
Which will be cool.
Yeah, we'll have to hit that up later on and talk about that. It looks like they're leaning towards that. So the Flash, I thought the outfit was pretty neat and doing the evolution of it. Though I think it's a little dark. I tend to like the lighter look of the Flash.
Yeah, the colors are dulled down, but I think overall the tone of the show is brighter and lighter. He actually enjoys being a superhero. You know, whereas everybody else just seems like being a superhero is a burden, and we got to be like Batman and just angst ridden because my parents got killed in an alley. And but you know, you don't get that with the Flash.
You know, if anything, I'd say this is the show to beat. This is the top superhero show on TV right now. My opinion, I think this should set the bar. This is a good show.
Yeah, it takes itself as kind of being fun. I think it ends on kind of a serious note, but it takes itself being sort of fun. I mean, you even had Gorilla Grodd was in
That was awesome.
One of the episodes, and that was, I mean, you can make that work. You can make anything work with comic book stuff. You had Firestorm, which is kind of fun. Now you got the interplay between the younger guy and the older guy. I can't remember their names.
Tom Cavanaugh was playing him, which is in Professor Zoom World. That was just well done. I mean, they created that. We actually like each other at first, and slowly start to get to distrust, and then you see that, oh crap, this is what's going to happen. And you know he's not going. Matter of fact, I think from what little clips I've seen from the League of Legends or whatever, I think he's going to be in that.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, we got somebody can run and travel through time and super fast. Oh, that was one of the fun things. Okay, this would be spoiler territory, so pause.
Dan Slott, spoiler alert. Dan Slott, spoiler alert.
I maybe come back later, but. When you saw the little classic Flash.
Oh, yeah.
Helmet come flying through the end, you know, like through that, whatever that time portal was like, hey, cool, the actual classic Flash. So maybe we'll see that.
Yeah, through time, probably because of the Speed Force. Oh, yeah, Jay Garrick. I got superhero wood when I see that. It's like, boy, yeah. So my wife's like, what? And don't get me wrong, my wife follows all this stuff, and it's big in this, but she didn't recognize it like I did right away. And I was like, that is so cool.
Right.
That's going to be awesome. As I said, I love the show. I think the story is good. The characters are good. Even though, you know, they put in some actors that, you know, for diversity that were originally white, the actors play them are great actors. The only kind of kick I have, which still I don't have any major issue with, is you have Barry Allen in his job and all that, but he's really more like Wally West.
Yeah. And I wasn't a big DC reader in the 90s or even in the 80s. So Wally West, I think, when does he become the Flash? I think because they had, was it Crisis on Infinite Earths or something like that? And Barry Allen dies, but he gets better.
Yeah, Barry Allen dies. I can't remember exactly when, but Flash was Wally in the 90s.
And so throughout the 90s, I think the zeros, I think Wally West was primarily the Flash.
Yeah, as well in 2000 for probably a decade, too. He's the Flash for around 20 years.
Yeah, so he was the Flash for about 20 years. I think the same thing when you look at Green Lantern. I think it was Jon Stewart and Kyle Rayner. I think we're mostly Green Lantern.
Generic Green Lantern.
And Hal Jordan, you know, he became a villain and disappeared. You know, like in the 90s, they basically were, you know, DC was trying to really change all of their heroes and, you know, all the bright happiness of the characters and just making them dark. And,
well, you know how to darken them up, don't you? You got to shove the girlfriend in the refrigerator.
Oh, yeah, jerk, yeah, Ron Mars. yeah, no kidding. I mean, they broke Batman's back. They killed Superman. Wonder Woman snaps a guy's neck. I mean.
Oh, I forgot about that with the Wonder Woman.
All kinds of crazy things were going on in the 90s with the characters. And by the end of that, I think everyone's just getting to be too dark and too crazy. Like, again, it comes down to the back to the Squadron Sinister. It's like, who are we rooting for and why are we rooting for?
Yeah. So ultimately, though, you agree with me, though, Flash is the show that would have raised the bar for television.
I think Flash is a really good superhero TV show. And you have to think as a TV show overall, I think it's good. I think if they have you got the one guy from Prison Break playing, was it Captain Cold?
Yeah.
And the guy who was his brother,
which is also Squadron's going to be in the League of Legends.
Cool. The guy who was his brother in Prison Break is also playing his brother in the show. Was it Heatwave? I think.
Yeah. I noticed that.
Like, that is awesome casting. So if they don't take themselves too seriously, but don't take it too campy, I think the show could go on for a little while. It's going to really depend on what they do. You know, I was never a big Flash reader. And so that's why for me it's kind of fun. I know enough about the Flash, but not so much that I'm like, oh well, this changes what happened in issue number 38. With I'm glad that's not going to happen.
Just as some spoilers too. It's from what I've seen, it looks like, as we mentioned, those guys that were going to be in it, the Atom's going to be in it as well. League of Legends. Also, it looks like Black Canary.
Oh.
But not the one from Green Arrow, the current, the one that they killed off is going to be in it.
No, it's comics. If you die, you get better.
So we'll see what happens. Yeah, it should be interesting.
I heard Hawk Girl's supposed to be on that, so that could be cool.
Oh, wow.
The League of Legends. If that's their Justice League-type show.
Yeah, that would be slick. All right, well, jumping on to the next topic. It has been released information now about more information about Spider-Man. Now, granted, we're not Spider-Man Crawl Space. We still love Spider-Man 2, so we got something that big. We've got to talk about it a little bit. So Spider-Man comics, definitely jumping into a new direction. Now, when I should say amazing, because Spider-Man's going to be Miles Morales for the Spider-Man book,
yes,
which is going to have the rogues gallery of Peter that's keeping him street level. And Peter's now going to become global. You know, and he's got his own Spider-Mobile, and he's rich, and he's got his company now. Slot.
Yeah, it's billionaire playboy Peter Parker, who we can all identify with, because we don't have billionaire playboy Bruce Wayne or billionaire playboy Tony Stark or formerly billionaire playboy Ted Kord and billionaire – I mean, no.
You mean this is like Tony Stark and – and Bruce Wayne? Never.
It could be.
It's so original. But you know what? Thank goodness we can relate to this. Because if you recall, Marvel said we can't relate to a married Peter. I mean, that's no. We can't. But we can all relate to being a playboy with multiple chicks and being filthy rich.
Yeah, all the time. I drove my spider vehicle to work today. So.
Which just shows you one more thing, that Marvel, a lot of people writing, especially for Marvel, probably have not had much interaction with women.
No.
Sorry.
You son of a bitch.
But it made me think of the spider vehicle, because there is a thing on the picture I saw, which might be the first cover. He's in a spider vehicle. It made me think of the spider buggy from the 70s.
Yeah, I think that's what it's supposed to do.
The Human Torch made that for him, and it was just, all the fans hated it. So eventually I think they trashed it and it got dumped into the East River or something. I think that'll end up.
Well, remember, this. I think Dan Slott says, this is the Spider-Man that we were all wanting.
Yes.
I don't know about you. I did not want this.
I didn't either.
I wanted Peter Parker.
Yeah, Peter Parker to have his problems.
I mean, I understand the guy can have a win once in a while and build, but this is, come on. Yeah, and you also got to think about this setup, too. He earned none of this.
Yeah.
He did not earn a degree. He did not start to build the business that's successful. This is all probably another build-up for Doc Ock coming in.
Yeah, Spider-Doc.
Oh, jeez.
Or Sprock.
What a pile of slot. This is just a pile of slot.
Yes, and slot strikes again. I don't know if he'll be back or not, because you were telling me that people were giving him crap.
And he's getting a lot of crap.
Like with John Byrne and...
Well, yeah, John Byrne as well as other spots, which makes a good segue to online behavior. So we'll let me look into that and pull up my notes here. I've got that. You can go to the John Byrne's website. He has a forum, the John Byrne forum, and that is quite a telling situation there. He has a long discussion with John Byrne. As a matter of fact, it's up to right now 17 pages, but I think the interaction mainly between those two were within the first 12 pages. And Byrne clearly discusses that he's not a big fan of this new direction, as well as some of the other people on – quite a few of the people on the other forum. Some are comic shop owners and things like that. You know, and I don't think Byrne was being disrespectful. You know, as a matter of fact, one of the responses of Slott, of course, expresses the all-too-common fanish position, and the change is good. And a quick review of the last 40 years or so shows us, well, that how well that's worked out. And I think that's a good point. He put, my reading is that Peter would have been extraordinarily even without the powers. Also, when Ben told Peter him about with great power, you know, must come great responsibility, Ben was speaking to Pete's intellect, not his mutation as well. And, you know, he's really saying that, and he goes on more, that he's not the character he used to be. He's writing him out of character.
Right.
And Dan Slott came in there and was responding to these comments, which, you know, kudos for Dan Slott for going into this, you know,
right.
And doing that, because Dan Slott usually will only go to forums and things like that that will cater to him.
Right.
So, and hide things that make him look good. So it says, so he quotes, they are, but I bet they don't think they are. Slott, of course, expresses the all too common fanish position that I mentioned Byrne said. And he goes on that, but then Slott responds, sorry about that. To be fair, Mr. Byrne, didn't a lot of your best runs of Marvel / DC comics start with the premise of change is good? The Hulk and Bruce Banner get separated. Namor uses the wealth of the oceans to become a major Mongol. Superman's origins from Krypton through Smallville through Metropolis get changed and overhauled. She-Hulk becomes a break-the-fourth-wall style of comedy book, and so on. Reasonable comparisons, right? And Byrne responds, very well. And he goes, okay, he takes each one and says, to be fair to the, you know, each one I'm going to break down there. He says, let's take one at a time, shall we? The Hulk and Bruce Banner get separated. And that was intended to be permanent? No. Namor uses the wealth of the oceans to become a major Mongol, which he'd done before with Stan and Jack back at the helm. Superman's origins for Krypton through Smallville through Metropolis get changed and overhauled, he said, which had happened many times before and since and didn't change the character. She-Hulk becomes a break, the fourth wall style of comedy book, and once again he said, but still didn't change the character, and so on, such as reasonable comparisons, right? He says, you seem to think so. There's the problem in the nutshell. And he's right. He's saying, I didn't change the overall character. I changed the situations, but the character stayed the same. Then, you know, Slott came in and disagreed, and I think that's the part of the problem right there, is Dan Slott doesn't understand that he does change the character. I think he's thinking he doesn't.
Yeah, you know, if you go back and read, like, there's a whole bunch of essential, Marvel has a bunch of essential books, like Essential X-Men, Essential Iron Fist. You'll see a lot of the stuff that John Byrne worked on. I think he even worked on the Fantastic Four. And things changed in the 80s. You know, in the 60s, what the appeal of Marvel was that the characters actually changed over time. They dealt with things. You know, Reed Richards and Sue Richards were married, and they went through marital problems, and they had kids, and, you know, Peter Parker was doing things. He was in high school, and he graduated, and he went to college, and, you know, all those things, I think, seemed to change once Marvel started making a lot, started making pretty good money, and they started producing TV shows, and, you know, once the company started really raking in cash, the characters stopped progressing. And so there was slowly progression. There was the illusion of progression. And then the 80s happened, and then they progressed things forward again. You know, Peter Parker and Mary Jane get married in the 80s. And then who knows what happened in the 90s? Something bad.
the 90s, that should
the
say
investor
that.
Boom, Rob Liefeld, and other Ooh. Things of the 90s. And today, I think we're still seeing kind of the scourge of that today is kind of the Image Comics effect of what's going on. You look at DC and you look at Marvel, you know, it's can we be more like Image Comics as opposed to, you know, whatever our history and heritage was, which is sticking to the characters. And then back to Dan Slott. Dan Slott doesn't understand Spider-Man. Because I think you were saying that.
Clearly.
Dan Slott sees Spider-Man as a spoiled child, wasn't that his thing?
He sees him as selfish, and he compares his being good to like being on the on the wagon, on being like an alcoholic. And once in a while, he goes back to being selfish again, like good old Pete.
Yeah,
which is not right.
Pete never did that. So what I was thinking is characters as metaphors. You know, like I was sitting there, I was trying to doodle Venom, and it occurred to me that the character Venom as a metaphor is like addiction. You know, so I thought if you really think of that character, because he wants to possess thing and possess you the way an addiction does. But if you look at Spider-Man as a metaphor, it means what? He's integrity and, you know, power and responsibility. You know, power used responsibly combined with integrity. And that really is Peter Parker and that Spider-Man. And Dan Slott doesn't get that. I think he had that freedom to go and say, oh, I can do whatever I want with, you know, superior Spider-Man.
Well, you look too, Dan Slott doesn't use his power responsibly. He's got how many people behind him rallying all these fans and stuff like that, and he goes to websites and stuff that cater to him, that will protect him and keep him from any negativity. He shelters himself all around all positivity, and if anybody says anything bad, they're either banned or disappeared and things like that. So,
you're out!
So, yeah, I guess it makes sense. It's the way he sees things.
Right. Well, I am a henchman. I am not a fanatic. Yeah. So Slott has his own fanatics.
Yeah. Now, Slott did respond to John Byrne. And once again, I apologize, I bastardized a little bit because the John Byrne form is a little bit weird how it reads. This is, again, I disagree. The way you changed her character was profound. She became completely different in the way that she was in David Anthony Kraft's run on Savage. He's talking about She-Hulk, Stern's Avengers. And even your Fantastic Four in your run of Sensational, you gave the character a license to be goofy, a little bit screwball, and more upbeat than anyone had portrayed her before. The big change to her character means to this day because the risks you were willing to take in that book. And now here I think John Byrne replies gracefully and maybe not so gracefully, but accurately. He said, like I said, the problem is obvious, and it's yours. He just doesn't, you know, Slott doesn't get it. Later on, I said, I quite like the idea of Peter using his smarts to make some actual gains for once. You know, and I know there's a tendency to always want to paint him as that eternal high school loser figure, but too much doom and gloom can get really weary for a while. And he responded, and you know what's supposed to happen when it gets weary? You're supposed to move on. You are not supposed to selfishly demand that the comics and characters change to fit your needs, nor are the writers, artists, editors supposed to pander to the ever-diminishing pool of people who make such demands.
Hold up. Yo, what did my boy just say? Can somebody please rewind that?
And so I think he's really calling out there. Dan Slott is writing the character that he wants, not what the character should be.
Yeah, I think ultimately that's it. It's like it's fan fiction, not, you know, like a professional writer taking on the character. Because if you have a character and there's an ongoing thing, you know, like a way of being about it. Like I said, the metaphor concept is, if you take Superman, maybe you want to change something here or there about it. Like things change, times change, you know, things like that change. But certain elements of a character shouldn't change. You know, Superman should be the guy who's, you know, about truth, justice in the American way, integrity, you know, not fighting General Zod and having buildings collapse left and right like in Man of Steel. You know, a Batman is a crusader for good and justice and things like that. Although lately he's just pretty much a bruiser, just crushes people But he's still good somehow.
Yeah. One other thing Byrne said, this one's a little bit, he's starting to get a little harsh here. He says, but you'll forgive me for not having the greatest confidence in anything that Marvel is doing. They've shit on characters I love so much at this point that they have no part of my interest left.
Yeah.
To peak, you know, it's a fool once, and I think he's absolutely right.
Now, Byrne said that about Marvel, what they're doing now?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Byrne himself is kind of a controversial guy, and he'll say controversial things from time to time. But that's, I have to say, that's really right on. And, you know, like I said, at Crawl Space, they're acknowledging that, you know, the fans really don't matter anymore. And I think that really shows with some of the new books that are coming out and a lot of the things they're doing.
Right. And now the thing I got out of this, too, and I'm going to go on to other things here. So they have a conversation. Definitely check it out. I think it's worth a good read, even though it's a lot of pages, at least especially the first 12, where they have a lot of discussion back and forth. And you hear from other people, too, like that run comic shops and say, well, what about kids, readers, and things like that, too, and bring up some very good points. But one thing I want you to notice, too, and I found this is very, very important, is you'll notice Dan Slott keeps a professional tone in this, which you don't see very often at all. And there's the positive and the negative. It proves he can do it, and I applaud him for that. But then it brings the negative.
Right.
He only does that when it's a forum place that he can't control or have some kind of special power. If he goes to CVR or something, let's be honest, they're nothing but marketing tools, really, for comic books. He will be an absolute jerk. I mean, it used to be in the Marvel forums, you'd say something, the moderators would come in and change it, warn you, and they'd remove it. They'd remove posts to protect Dan's slot, and things all of a sudden disappeared. Whereas here, he knows they're going to stay, so he's got to watch what he says. You look, this Dan's slot doesn't really frequent forums and things like that that he can't have control in. He won't touch the Spider-Man crawl space anymore because people lit him up and told him how they felt. You know, as well as others. He's been invited through other discussions to come to other forums where there are a level playing field where that couldn't happen, and he would refuse to do it. He just, you know, he just won't do it. So, you know, he has the ability to do that, but he's sort of, let's be honest, he's a bit of a bully.
You know, and I'm just looking at, because I'm looking at the little icon with Dan Slott, it's got Spider-Man. He might identify more with the superior Spider-Man, because it's like, you know, Doc Ock takes over Spider-Man's brain. Dan Slott took over Spider-Man. I think he's more like Doc Ock.
Yeah, and that's probably why he can write the Superior Spider-Man so much better. I mean, to be honest, Superior Spider-Man was probably the highlight of his Spider-Man run. Okay, well, you know, there is other issues, too, for other people that were not behaving really well. There's an article on with the Outhousers that's worth a definite look and reading as well. I'm pulling it up right now. Here it is. It says, Fanboy Rampage, Dan Slott versus Bleeding Cool's Hannah Means Shannon. And this is what I'm saying. When you read the tone, I definitely think you should do that of the one, but the John Byrne, and then read how his Twitter responses are to somebody else that he can't, you know, because he's got his whole Twitter pack behind him that he can rally up. It says, main Spider-Man writer Dan Slott took some shots at Bleeding Cool editor-in-chief Hannah Means Shannon on Twitter today after an interview with Means Shannon on the World Balloon podcast raised his heckles, or whatever it says. The tweets were taken from a tweet deck, as Slott has blocked both the Outhouse and myself on Twitter for reasons unknown. And it shows these, well, I'll read some Dan Slott ones. It says, your interview with Bleeding Cool's EIC is insane, because I am honestly amazed they don't burst into flames right there. Then he says, when they said we're not interested in messing up the production of comics and their NAD and Ed Marvel leaks, but the lie to that. In other words, he's mad that Bleeding Cool is leaking information, you know, being a journalist, right?
You ignorant sluts.
By revealing comics that Marvel is already producing. Big shocker. And then Dan Slott puts, Bleeding Cool, we're helping the industry. Wow, ask any staffer at Marvel if they think that's what they're doing. Any staffer. Now, Means Shannon took time out then of her schedule for assessing the Bleeding Cool staff members to correct Rich Johnson's many typos as usual and respond to Dan Slott. And their response is, is they me? Sounds like we work with Marvel in ways you don't know about, Dan. Apparently, Dan has a real problem acknowledging my gender as EIC of the Bleeding Cool editor and controller or something like that. He can't use she. And then Rich Johnson comes in. Revealing your gender would be a spoiler, Anna, and we can't have that. They've had an issue with the spoilers, so that's why Dan Slott's here whining in the first place.
Right.
And then Hannah responds to, I'm surprised by Dan's ignorance of how his own publisher operates with press. Dan responds, okay, how is this? I was surprised that someone's blatant lies that EIC of Bleeding Cool said on her Word Balloon interview. Do you acknowledge that the AMAD Marvel leaks you posted on Bleeding Cool made creators and staffers jobs harder at Marvel? I am aware of how your site operates with Marvel. You threaten them with one leak unless they give you a lesser one. Really? So Bleeding Cool is extorting Marvel? Come on, for payola. I mean, let's be honest here. Marvel regularly and willingly exchanges with media outlets for fawning press coverage all the time.
Right.
How dare they? And yeah. So Hannah responds, nope. Many were set to go exclusive the same day on various sites. The rest had already been leaked elsewhere, same day revealed. So in other words, unless Dan Slott can control the press, he's pissed.
Right.
And Dan Slott responds, you're being deliberately misleading when you say the rest had already been leaked elsewhere. At the Beat, you had ethics. Now, I just want to point out here, the Beat never had that great of ethics, I didn't think. Here's a really funny thing I found. When I had read about the disconnect about numbers and sales and things, there, a thing was pointed up that the sales of Spider-Man was having a steeper slide than some X-Men book. But yet when the Beat wrote it, they said the X-Men had a big slide, but the Superior had a very gentle downward, you know, they softened it up. And Dan Slott, oh, you know, this is fair and non-biased. But if you look into it, oh, Dan Slott was out having donuts and stuff. Uh-huh, that's unbiased. In other words, if I can control it, it's okay. I mean, really. And then it's on the She-Hulk. He said, you were a decent writer, is how I would have replied that if I were Hannah. I mean, shit. Says your leaks at Bleeding Cool made creators and staffers' jobs harder last week at Marvel, and you stretched them out for page clicks. You know, and then goes on, the article tells more, but then he says enough silliness for this week, and he leaves because, you know, Dan Slott has to leave when he starts to realize he's losing intellectual,
right,
and he has no ammo.
He makes, when I was a kid, there was a neighborhood kid, and to prevent a lawsuit, I won't say his name. But
that's why we're henchmen.
He was a kind of shady kid. He was a spoiled kid. He had everything. He had all the Star Wars toys. His dad bought everything for him. On his 16th birthday, he got a brand new car because his dad bought it for him. And this kid, I never knew what it was like to actually have to work for anything. But anyway, everybody else liked him. And because I had friends in the neighborhood, I liked my friends. But I didn't like this kid, but I played with this kid because all my friends did. And we would play a game. And this kid, if he owned the game, like it was Monopoly or any game, basically, he would say, oh, we can't do it that way because the rules say this. So he'd keep changing the rules and changing the rules. And there's a term in philosophy when you're looking at logical fallacies, and there's a term called moving the goalpost.
Which he does.
And Dan Slott is like that kid I grew up with, and who moves the goalpost. So he's changing the rules to fit it so that only he can win. And it's just like, that doesn't work, you know. And you know, whenever you've got somebody in a corner, you've got somebody pinned, they move the goalposts. They change the criteria of what they're arguing about or, you know, trying to defend. You know, like if we look at the numbers of Spider-Man sales, you know, Dan says, oh, no, it's doing great. But the only way he can keep it going great is by doing gimmick after gimmick after gimmick.
But that's not gimmick, that's story.
Exactly. And it's, again, it's the moving the goalpost thing.
Well, did he not move the goalpost to get his sales boost in numbers, too, that he claims 20,000+ boost in sales?
Yeah, by using gimmicks. But
well, if you look before that too, what he's talking about is he's counting from when sales are down around average around 55,000. That was when he was one of the core four writers
right.
of the books. Before that, the sales were over 100,000 per. It was like 155,000 average. He got out the book, it dropped to the 50s, like 55,000 average, got it up to 80 and bragged he rose sales. How is that an increase?
It's not.
Oh, okay.
But if we're playing by slot rules.
But that's moving the goalposts.
We can
right?
move the goalposts.
Okay.
And you can, if you can't win an argument, at least keep, you know, changing the criteria of what you're arguing about.
Somebody yanked the ball out from Charlie Brown on that one. Oh, wait a minute. Dan Slott said Charlie Brown has never kicked the ball, but he was wrong about that, too, because he did in the episode, the magic one, where he became invisible. But once again, what does he know?
He's Dan Slott.
Right. I hate to pick on just Dan Slott. As I said, this has been a big week for comic pros behaving badly,
right.
Because another one is that Arthur Sudan. He took up four tables in an artist. You know, in a con, and pissed off a lot of his fellow creators.
Whoa, what? Guys, don't be like my friend here who didn't do anything.
So he does Marvel Zombies, if I'm not mistaken, and according to the tweets and things that you've read up, we've read on that, was at the Montreal Comic Con, and, you know, he took up other people's slots. Evidently, this is sort of a common dick move for him.
Okay.
He's supposedly done it at other ones, but who knows? I mean, we weren't there, so we don't know if there was a disconnect or what, but it does make him look dickish.
Well, when I saw the picture, I've been to comic book conventions, and I've seen it. It does take up a big amount of space. He's the Marvel Zombies guy, right?
Yeah.
He does the artwork. So, but if he's taking up other people's tables, that's totally not cool.
Absolutely not. I mean, it's taken away from him. But then again, if it was an agreement that there was a miscommunication, it probably could have been handled better. But to add on to the dickish behavior, you've got other writers like Ron Mars, which we already mentioned, taking pop shots and things like that. You know, oh, he's taking tables that could be used. Well, I got a good idea. Why doesn't Ron Mars give up his table? Because, I mean, really, that's a waste of space in the first place.
Well,
whoopsie, that was
good. He does have, what, 6,000, 7,000 people buying his current book.
So. Oh, yeah, massive sales.
Ridiculous and unbelievably small.
Yeah, I guess that supports his dickish behavior, like doing tweets that happens again and again, almost like zombie behavior. And I guess he said he's got a con that he's going to that they're both supposed to be in. And so, you know, that might, you know, create some kind of thing, which I don't buy for a second. I think Ron Mars is a lot of tweet talk. And you when know, it comes to reality, it's, you know, come on now.
There's probably that, you know, because I've been to comic book conventions, and I usually ask comic book artists how they draw certain things and try to get feedback from them. And I can tell, like, the people actually care about the fans and actually are interested in talking to the fans versus not. And you get, you know, they all have personalities, they all have egos. And it's just some of these guys, I think, are so full of themselves. And some of the guys are really laid back and easygoing. Have you ever met Bill Sienkiewicz? He's one of the most laid back, easygoing guys, coolest guys. You'll meet, but some of these guys think they're all that in a bag of chips. You know, like Greg Horn has this really elaborate booth, and it's got all this, and there's always tons of people around him. Although I did meet him, and he was friendly to me. So, but he just looks like the kind of guy who'd be super pretentious. But I have to say, you know, he answered my question. He was really friendly, but it looked like a lot of hype. But you know, we could do a whole episode about artwork.
And we'll be planning to add a bigger spotlight on that soon. But yeah, as you see there, it was, you know, I agree. I'm glad some artists started rallying up and writers and things, you know, say, talk about that. But maybe it should have been done also as well as out of the public eye. You know, I mean, come on, this is their industry they're working in. And being a Twitter tough guy, I mean, really, you know, calling him a douche king and stuff like that.
Right.
I'm sorry. I tend to believe that Ron Mars is not going to say that to his face. Talking big on the internet, throwing punches behind a keyboard, make you look like a fucking dumb kid. I mean, granted, I'm not saying Arthur's a big guy or anything, but I see a lot of hateful stuff from Ron Mars' tweets, and I find it hard to believe he can back any of that up.
Yeah, I'm looking at the tweet now where it says, you see douche king Arthur Saddam, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, dude, if you don't like somebody, you're in a profession, just don't talk to him or don't talk about him. Like, you got to be professional. And
right.
That's the way I look at it first. If he's, you know, if this guy's making that kind of attitude, it makes sense that he's on a book. What is it, John Carter, Warlord of Mars, or
yeah,
something, and he's selling 6,000, 7,000 books. He's alienating, you know, fans. He's alienating everybody. Like, I can't remember who it was, but I was up at one of the Motor City cons in Detroit, and this DC artist, his artwork was really great, and I tried talking to him, and he was just a total ass. And I'm like, well, that explains why, you know, you're here and having a good time. You know, for some of these guys, I guess maybe they're in the business or whatever for too long. Maybe they become jaded or, you know, the thing with comic book conventions is they're supposed to be for the fans. It should not be an opportunity where you go in to try to market and make money off the fans. I mean, you're going to do that anyway, but it's a chance to really meet the fans. I mean, where else do you really get that kind of connect to the creators of something? I mean, you know, if you have an auto show, you don't really get to go meet the engineers at Ford or Toyota or something like that. If you go to a Hollywood convention, you really don't get to meet. I mean, if you get to meet a celebrity, somebody who's on, you know, in a TV show or movie, you'll get a chance to say hi to them for about, you know, 2 minutes, shake their hand, and they're always trying to sell you a photograph of them at, you know, $20. Have a signed photograph of me.
Yeah.
The comic book artists, though, you're going to get more of a conversation. Like, there's a guy, Freddie Williams, the third, really friendly guy. Again, another great guy you can go up and chat with, and he'll talk your ear off. He created a book, how to create digital comics. Run, don't walk, and get a copy of that if you're interested in making digital comics. You know, like I said, I'll talk up anybody I've met you know, who's been nice to me and give me good feedback. Ryan Stegman, I saw him do a really good cover. He's kind of a funny guy. He gives me feedback. I'll think of others. You know, again, like there's we'll do a podcast at some point about artists.
There we go. Yeah, you know, I have to say though, if you want to read some entertaining tweets, go ahead and read Rod Mars, because I tell you, it's like filled with hate. You know, he doesn't have a whole lot of nice things to say. Complain about his baseball team, which granted Mets suck. But anything that begins with a C for conservatism evidently is the devil. You know, and things that don't agree. If he doesn't like the artwork, you suck, which is fascinating. He does. If you don't like Twilight, it sucks. I think he's jealous. And granted, I don't think Twilight is good either, but it sure as hell sells a lot better than this crap.
Whoa! Damn! I'm sorry, man. I thought this was the bathroom.
I would imagine if there's a Twilight comic, he'd be the guy probably writing on it and probably eat his words.
I mean, look at it. As I said before, we don't have a lot of assholes in comics, but the ones we do have are big assholes. I think he was looking in the mirror when he read that. Right. I mean, wrote that. I mean, come on. You know, you need to grow up a little bit. The guy is, what, 50-something, maybe even older? Time to be a professional.
By the time y'all show some respect around here.
I can't remember. But Mars is the guy who wrote with Kyle Rayner.
Yeah.
I met the guy who was the artist that worked with Ron Mars. Real nice guy. I met him. He was at the Mid-Ohio Comic Con in Columbus.
I like the artwork in those books, too.
And I can't remember the guy's name, but if you look it up, you'll see him. Run, don't walk to see that guy. You know, tell him how awesome he is. The guy could definitely use the press. But he's the guy who invented the way Kyle Rayner's look looked.
Hmm. Probably the best thing about the book.
Perhaps. And I was a big Green Lantern fan in the 80s or 90s. So it wasn't until, what, the Zeros? The War of the Rings, I think, when that started happening.
I don't know. Ever since reading that, though, I know I got to watch out when I go to the refrigerator and grab a beer.
There's
my wife's
going
to be stubbed. Oh,
girlfriend's there. Damn you, Sinestro. I don't know who did it. It might have been Sinestro.
Well, I don't remember anymore either. I'm going to have to look. I just didn't care enough. They sort of ruined the book, I thought, for a while. All right, so that was a list we had here for this week's, because evidently this is a common trend now. Artists and writers can't, more writers than anything, can't seem to behave themselves.
Yes.
Oh. Anything else you'd like to add about Secret Wars?
Nothing else about Secret Wars. Just, you know, I went onto Marvel's website to look some information up, and if you don't have Flash, it doesn't work.
Okay.
I mean, okay, great. Everybody's got Flash. Which I didn't, because I was looking at it at a place where I wasn't allowed to download Flash. But there should be at least a JPEG version or something like that, so somebody could click on it or something a little more interactive or something fun. You know, if you were like playing a video game, and Marvel could pick up on this, but they probably won't. But they, if it was like a video game and you saw your progress in a game, like I used to play these old, you know, Romance of the Three Kings type games, which is like conquering ancient China, and there was like other things where you conquered ancient Japan, and slowly you saw your progress, like all the colors on the map would start to turn a certain color. Do an interactive map like that ties people in, like, oh, okay, this faction is really dominating in the battle world, and I mean, that would be really cool. It'd be another way to tie things in.
Oh, that would be cool. Keep you checking up and seeing the progress as it goes.
And even if you were like a casual fan, you'd at least say, oh, okay, so the comic book I'm reading actually is relevant to something going on in this world. And it's just like, we've got video games and they've been around since the 80s and 90s. And I don't know if any of these guys at Marvel have actually played video games, or maybe they think they're superior to it. They don't do that now. Or, you know, they think they're all that in a bag of chips and should be carried around on a palanquin or something.
Exactly.
But,
you know, and I think a great way to wrap that up is the same article I was talking about earlier with Dan Slott in the Bleeding Cool issue by Jude Terror, I believe he wrote it, for the Outhousers, said,
right,
at the heart of the issue is the belief of Dan Slott and some of the top brass at Marvel that the purpose of comic book press is to serve Marvel's interest. That if the press isn't helping to sell comic books for Marvel, they should be treated with hostility and are somehow failing in their duty as journalists. Though they're wrong, the purpose of these of the press isn't to sell comics. It's to inform and entertain the people who are, in case, the comic book reading audience, and for the readers of Bleeding Cool, for example.
Right.
These readers don't care if Marvel gets to consumerate their relationship with their media partners at CBR, Newsarama, IGN, USA Today, Entertainment Weekly, The Nerdist, or whatever big name site they're giving an exclusive to on any particular day. They just want to know about comics news and don't need it spoofed to them right. You know, with publisher-approved glorified press releases. We want the truth about this stuff. And that's one of the reasons, you know, this website, and this podcast exists, is we're not going to pander to them. If we think it sucks, we're going to say it. If we like it, we're going to admit it.
Right.
I said, fuck you and your eyebrows.
I mean, you know, maybe there is a need for a comics gate. You know, maybe that's why a lot of these, I've seen them, matter of fact, I'm picking on the same guys a lot right now. Ron right. Mars, all these are against Gamergate so bad. Maybe it's because they're afraid of the ethics in comics journalism when it's going to come out. You know, is it going to be found out how much of this is just really marketed stuff?
Yeah, there could be that. In the last podcast, I talked a little bit about nerd rage. I think we talked a little bit about nerd rage.
Rage!
And I think we've got to be careful of, you know, too much nerd rage against somebody like Dan Slott. I think we just need to, you know, vote with our dollars and just say, okay, enough's enough. If this guy thinks he's all that, great. More power to him. But just stop buying Spider-Man.
Yeah. I mean, I think as a person, he's probably a dick. And I don't care for his books, but I'm not going to hunt him down and want to pound him in the streets. So I disagree with him. I don't like it. He probably doesn't like me. I'm sure after his podcast, he hates me.
Right.
Even more, if not already. You know, but I don't have real true hatred towards him. I, you know, I would hope he has a good career. I hope he finds a book that he can write and be successful. I hear Silver Surfer's good. I have never read it, but I hear it's good.
I wouldn't read Silver Surfer, but still.
I haven't checked it, so I can't comment, you know, on that. But, well, you know what? To be nice to him and try to do something. He did an Avengers run for a little while.
Right.
The Mighty Avengers, it was on his end, it was canceled at that part. But I think it was just like, okay, take it, run it. And granted, there was some stupid stuff I couldn't stand in it, like Hank Pym sleeping with a robot pretty much who was made to be like Janet Van Dyne. But he did create some cool things like the Infinite Avengers Mansion, which doors could open to anywhere and lead to them, which was really awesome and, you know, utilized Hank Pym's intelligence and things. So I was impressed by that.
Yep.
So it's not all bad. I think he's got to find the right place and maybe tell him to tone it down a little bit. He's like a little 12-year-old about sex stuff. He's got to throw it in and giggle all the time.
Yep. Well, it comes back to that kid, you know, that I knew way back when. That kid was a pretty immature guy. Also, and I don't know. It gives Slott some kind of crazy thing. Maybe he'll go work for Archie Comics or something down the road, but I don't know.
You join Mark Waid.
Afterlife with Archie. I don't know. But Spider-Man's kind of an iconic character, and I can see people being upset when you change things or alter things. And I can understand doing something like what John Byrne was saying for the sake of the character and for storytelling. But again, it's sort of like the core of the character of Spider-Man, you know, is, you know, being responsible with power and having integrity. And the reason Peter Parker always feels guilty and always it's that Parker guilt, that Parker luck, he's always down on his luck is because, you know, he lost his Uncle Ben and they lost Gwen Stacy and there was Captain Stacy and he's always losing something.
Yeah, you know, and people gravitated to Spider-Man for years because of the character Peter.
Yeah.
And so getting too far away from Peter is, I think, a big mistake.
Yep.
You know, they can say, well, we want to keep it fresh for new readers, but you got to remember, that first book could be anybody's first book, and it needs to be Peter.
Yeah, he's got to be the main character in his own book. And if they think, you know, Peter Parker, a.k.a. Tony Stark, is going to be relevant, well, they don't really understand what they're talking about. It's like you were telling me earlier about Spider-Woman. Or Spider-Girl, Spider-Woman.
Oh, yeah, we should cover that on another one, Spider-Woman Pregnant. Okay.
Yeah, it was a case of you could hear Fonzie's motorcycle starting to rev up. And it just – with the crew just is clueless about what their fans want or what they're interested in. I mean, it just – you can see where it's going to fail. And it just – how much longer are they going to sustain this?
Well, yeah, we'll definitely have to do Spider-Woman in the next podcast. We'll see if we can get some more information about that. All right. Well, that is it for the Henchmen's podcast episode 2. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you'll join us again later on for the next episode and many more after that. Until then, keep hidden from those heroes.
Right. Henchmen out.
Welcome to the world of Kundal!